topic of today's lecture is correlation analysis, slide 2. And I will talk about this. What is the notion of correlation? And then I'll define several different, looks like 5 different statistics and associated statistical tests. These are sometimes known as R, the pointwise biserial correlation, the Spearman correlation or rho, Goodman-Criscoll correlation or gamma, and the Kendall correlation or tau. Slide 3. I want to talk, before I dive into that, about a couple of the other null hypothesis tests we've seen so far and relate them into the notion of correlation by slightly redefining them. So I've given a couple of these here. So in the binomial test, the samples are Booleans. They're Bernoulli trials, coin flips, roughly. They either have true or false value, hit or miss. The null hypothesis is that the sample is drawn from some population with some probability of heads or true. And in the one sample test, like the one sample t-test or the Wilcoxon test, one sample version, the samples are what we call scalars, which is to say they're ratios, intervals, or counts. Real values or integers. And the null hypothesis is that the sample is drawn from some population with a certain mean, usually 0. Continuing onward, the paired tests, like the paired t-test or the paired Wilcoxon test, the samples are pairs A and B, where both A and B are scalars, and the null hypothesis is about the difference between those scalars in each sample. Slide 4. We've also seen the two-sample tests, like the two-sample t-test or the two-sample Wilcoxon test. And in that test, the samples are pairs of C and D, where C is the scalar, and here's where I'm changing it up just a little bit. D is a Boolean indicating group membership. We can say for convention that if D is false, the sample belongs to group 1, and if D is true, the sample belongs to a group 2. The null hypothesis is about whether the samples for whether these samples work here, whether they have the same or different means. Now, finally, we saw the Fisher exact test. And in that test, the samples are categorical pairs. So each pair, EF, E is categorical, usually Boolean, and F is categorical, also usually Boolean. The null hypothesis is about an association between the values of E and F. Slide 5. And correlation is actually most similar to the Fisher test. And in a correlation analysis, in both correlation statistics and in the associated tests, our samples are pairs G, H, where G and H are rank variables, interval variables, or ratio variables. So once again, we have 2 measures per case. Each sample contains measurements on 2 different scales. Or equivalently, we could say we have 2 rank or interval or ratio vectors, big G and big H, and these, of course, the same length. And we could say something like G sub I and H sub I represent a single observation. They define the pair, that is, each observation. What correlation statistics do for us is they quantify the association between these 2 variables. And so they give us a number that measures this quantification. They give us a statistic. And correlation tests allow us to build a null hypothesis test where the null hypothesis is usually that there is no association between G and H. Slide 6. Correlation is a very general approach, and it subsumes many other sort of methods. In fact, variants of it exist for both rank data and for interval ratio data, or mixes thereof. And finally, it's appropriate for both experimental and observational studies. So some examples you might have seen in the past is we might have a lexical decision task where people are asked to quickly identify whether something on the screen is or is not a word. We might ask whether that is at all sensitive to the number of letters in that word. Or we can ask whether there's a relationship between, say, the time spent studying the language and the score on a proficiency test for that language. Slide 7. So let's talk about these relationships here a little bit. Let's let each sample, once again, be a pair XY, where X and Y are, we'll say, rank or better variables. So qualitatively, we can describe the patterns of association like the following. We can say that if we see that when X is high, that means Y is high, and when X is low and Y is low, we might call that a positive association. I'll make this graphical in just a second. We also can talk about a negative association. A negative association is where when X is high, Y is low, and when Y is low, X is high. Or excuse me, is when X is low, Y is high. Or we can have a case where there's no association, like all four logical possibilities occur. We'll call that the none case. These can be visualized using what's traditionally called a scatter plot, which each x, y, and pair are sort of plotted on the Cartesian plane. Slide 8. I have some examples here. I mentioned positive correlation. You see, a perfect positive correlation might simply define a series of a line, whereas like a high positive correlation might look like sort of a line with a little bit of jitter or noise added to it. And of course, no correlation will just look like a total scatter. There'll be just total mess. And sort of moving to the right at the bottom there, we'll see like a perfect negative correlation would be a line with a negative slope. We also have an example at the top here of ice cream sales as a function of temperature. Obviously, as the temperature goes up, ice cream sales go up as well. So we see a positive association between temperature and profits. Slide 9. The way we measure association between interval variables, or better, is done with one of the earliest statistics we know, something called the Pearson product moment correlation coefficient, or Pearson's R. First, let us define a quantity called the sample covariance. The sample covariance of two variables, x and y, is given here. It's shown in the equation here. It's sometimes abbreviated COV, C-O-V, and in fact, that's what the function in R is called. It's called COV. You provide it two vectors and it computes the covariance, the sample covariance explicitly. And so you see here, there's a product in the top, a product of sums here, a sum of products, and where each one consists of the deviance of the x sample and the y sample from the mean. We take the product of those two, we sum that up, and we divide by n minus one, as we often do with sample statistics. So this is a measure, intuitively, of sort of like how much are x and y varying together, and it's based on a measurement of how much they deviate from their respective means. Slide 10. The simplest thing to tell you about this, though, is it's very closely related to the notion of variance, which we've already encountered. You see the formula looks sort of similar, but it's now in two variables. So I've given you here covariance, as defined before. Then I've given you variance, sort of written in the form of covariance. And you can see that it's covariance of a vector with itself is its variance. So in fact, sometimes you can view the so-called covariance matrix between a set of variables, and down the diagonal will be the variance itself. So the covariance of a variable with itself defines the variance. So covariance is a generalization of the variance formula. Slide 11. The way we interpret covariance is understood as the sum of products of deviations, as I said. And so if x, a little sample x is greater than the mean, and a sample y is greater than the mean, the product will be positive. And similarly, if they're both less than the means, the product will also be positive. And if they have alternate directions, they will have a negative product. And of course, if it's inconsistent, let's say if sometimes we have positive associations and we have negative associations, they will ultimately cancel each other out, given a large sample, yielding a value near to zero. Next slide, slide 12. But covariance also depends on the units of measure. So as a simple example, it's not merely a raw abstract measurement of how much do two variables think, but it depends on what kinds of units we measure them in. So for instance, if I had two variables that are measured in miles, their covariance will be quite a bit different than we measured in kilometers. And they're not even comparable at all. There's no simple, I can't take the covariance in kilometers and quickly convert it to the covariance in miles. So what Carl Pearson, the statistician, proposed was to standardize covariance by dividing it by the standard deviations of both variables. So we take, actually, it's literally the product of the standard deviations of the two variables. Sort of intuitively, this is a standardization procedure because it takes this thing that's expressed in products of x and y and scales it so that it's now expressed in a single unit, which is like roughly a unit of variance, a standard deviation. Slide 13. So once you do this operation, you get this statistic called little r, or Pearson's R. And not to be confused with R, the programming language. And this is a statistic which has a range between negative 1 and 1, where negative 1 is a perfectly negative correlation, 0 is no correlation, and plus 1 is a perfect positive correlation. I should note, of course, that the sign of this measure depends on how x and y are defined. So if I say, like, study time might have a positive correlation with the number of items answered correctly, but it would have a negative correlation with the number of items answered incorrectly. Obviously, I get to choose how I define my, say, y variable in this case. In some study cases where we doesn't actually really care about the sign, that often happens, we actually just want to know the magnitude of association as opposed to whether it's positive or negative. We can just take the absolute value and then we have a pure measure of association. Slide 14. Here's an example from a famous study by Sel Sternberg, who was a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania back in the day. And in this study, subjects are briefly shown one to six digits to remember. This is sometimes called the memory set. I believe they're shown them all at once in this study. Then after a short pause, that's taken away, and the subjects is then shown a single new digit, which is called the probe in the jargon of this experiment. Then they're asked to indicate whether the probe, this digit they were just shown, was found in the memory set or not. So the independent variable in this study is something like the size of the memory set. Sternberg was interested in how people's ability to recall sequence of digits varied as a function of the number of digits they were asked to recall in the first place. Because of this definition, and then finally we have a dependent variable, which is the reaction time expressed in seconds in this particular case. Slide 15. Here's an example trial. You're presented with numbers 3, 5, 2, 7, 9. You're given a probe 7. Since 7 is, as you can confirm for yourself, present in the memory set, your response is yes. Slide 16. Here's a plot directly from the Sternberg paper. What's called mean response latency is our dependent variable. It's RT, reaction time. That's along the y-axis, as our dependent variables usually. And then along the x-axis are the number of symbols in memory, that is to say the size of the memory set, which scales from 1 to 6. As you can confirm. As you see, there looks like you can see the plots here, and there's a little fit line as well. You see the little points, though. Forget the fit line for the moment. The points do appear to be going up as we proceed. It looks like it almost forms a pretty close to a straight line. In fact, Sternberg has given a formula for it there. Slide 17. So let's just repeat this analysis here, and we're going to actually compute the Pearson R statistic. We'll do it by hand first. So here I've defined X as the range 1 to 6. So in R, you can say something like if you type 1:6, that quickly defines a vector that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, it's a little bit like it's a little bit like the Python range command, but not quite, because it's inclusive on the both lower and upper bound. Just something to watch out for those of you who know R well. We also have defined y here. These are just the numbers directly from the study. I think these are some kind of means across subjects. And you see it's an increasing quantity. That's the reaction time in this particular case. Let's compute this by hand. We can compute the covariance statistics by taking x and y and running it through the COV function. I note that I didn't say COV equals COV because then I would sort of overwrite the function. I instead call it the full-length covariance just to prevent clash between the function names. I then take that covariance and I scale it by the sample standard deviation of x and by the sample standard deviation of y. We get a number here, 0.96. Or we can just use the R built-in here, the function called COR, which computes the correlation directly. And when you use that with no additional arguments, just the x and the y, it computes the Pearson correlation, or the Pearson product moment correlation. Slide 18. So let's turn this into a null hypothesis test. So let's imagine that at the population level, there is a real degree of association, which we'll call capital R. That's the amount of correlation at the population level, once again, not the sample. Let little r be the correlation statistic, which is the amount of correlation found in the actual sample. That's the one we just measured. Usually our null hypothesis is that at the population level, R is zero. And finally, we know that the correlation statistic little r has a known distribution. You can find tables for so-called R tables, which will be tables of the critical values for R at given alphas. And it will sort of, and you have to plug in one additional detail, which is n, the number of samples. Because obviously, as the sample size gets larger, our ability to reject the null hypothesis gets better. Or we can convert R into a t-statistic. There's sort of a known, it's a simple but like opaque formula that given an R, you can convert it into a t-statistic. Like they're closely related. And then we can just use our t-test table. This is desert island statistics. I don't need to do this very often. Slide 19. On slide 19 here, I show you the actual little sample of a table of this form. So for instance, If you're working at alpha level of 0.05, and you have four samples, then if you have a value of 0.811 or greater, you can reject the two-tailed null hypothesis. Slide 20. R also can run this entire procedure of both computing the correlation statistic, little r, and computing the null hypothesis test p-value all at once using a function called cor.test, our core test. And by default, once again, that runs the Pearson's product moment correlation statistic. Slide 21 shows you the actual result of that, of applying that. That's here. I've highlighted two numbers in red for those of you who see red. First off, of course, is the p-value. The second one is what it calls the sample estimate, which is in fact little r, the correlation statistic. So I think an appropriate way to report this is something like r equals 0.960 with p equals 0.002. That would be an appropriate report for this example. Using just simple, the name little r should be enough information for most people to cue them into that you're talking about the Pearson product moment a correlation statistic. If not, you could also say something like Pearson's R or Pearson product moment correlation R equals, up to you. Slide 22. There's a quantity some of you may have seen in the past, which is sometimes called R squared, or R square, is written as R with the exponent 2. This is, when you take the coefficient R and you square it, you compute what is sometimes known as the coefficient of determination, which can be interpreted a couple ways. One of them is as the proportion of variance shared by X and Y, or perhaps as the proportion of Y's variance related to or accounted for or explained by X. So for instance, if we have a little r of 0.1, then 0.01 or 1% of the variance is shared. If r is 0.9, then 81% of the variance is shared. And the easiest way to compute this in R is to compute the correlation statistic little r and then to multiply it by itself, which I've done here. So in the previous example, this is what happens if you just repeat the previous example, but you compute the R squared. We find out that 92% of the variance is accounted for. That is to say, nearly all the variance in reaction time is accounted for, 92% in particular, is accounted for by the size of the memory set. Slide 23. Key assumptions of these tests is that both X and Y are interval or ratio measures. By doing this, you assume that they are interval or better. This is not appropriate for rank data in the general case. We also assume that both X and Y are approximately normal. You can, of course, know what that means. The larger it is, the data sets are, the bigger you can deviate from that assumption safely. We also assume a linear relationship between X and Y. We'll be able to back off from that in just a second. We assume that both X and Y have roughly the same variance. We assume that is to say homoskedasticity. Though this is sort of a neglected assumption, but it is assumption of the test. Finally, we assume that outliers are rare or minimal. Slide 24. So here's some data, famous data, as it happens. It's called Anscombe's Quartet. And this data set is four different little scatter plots. They're all, of course, very small samples here, designed by the statistician Anscombe. And Anscombe was interested in showing how easy it was to break your R statistic here, your Pearson correlation statistic. So in the top left cell, you see what looks like a relatively strong correlation between X and Y. And of course, that's reflected. This data set, all four of them, as it happens, have an R of 0.82, roughly. All of them do. In fact, but look, then you look at the cell on the top right, where there's sort of a hyperbolic path here. And in that case, you actually have all the same summary statistics, even though it's not very linear. So it's clearly like a curve to be fit, but it's not a line. The same is true in the bottom left, which looks like pretty much the same, but there's a big outlier. You see one point that's way higher, way quite off the line. And finally, in the bottom right cell, there's actually a vertical trend plus one outlier. Interesting thing about this data is that X has the same mean, Y has the same mean, the standard deviation of x and y are the same, and all four of them have the same correlation statistics. This is evidence of sort of why you should scatter plot your data before just blindly applying the Pearson product motion correlation statistic. Only really the top left would be a good choice for that statistic. The other ones are dominated either by outliers in the bottom two or by a nonlinearity in the trend, as in the top right. Slide 25. One thing that may come up sometimes is what if y, the dependent variable, isn't actually continuously valued? It isn't interval or ratio. Well, there's a known adaptation of the Pearson statistic called the point biserial correlation, or the pointwise biserial correlation. This is actually mathematically equivalent to just computing the Pearson correlation, but then recoding one category or level of y as a 0 and the other as a 1. In fact, it doesn't have to be 0 or 1. It just has to be two integers that you fix, or two actually real values that you fix that are not equal. One thing about, this recoding procedure is that it makes the sign more or less arbitrary, so we often take the absolute value. Slide 26. The easiest way to do this in R is actually just to use the core function and then just provide it binary data. So here in X, I just sample from a uniform distribution. That's what RUNIF does. And then I take coin flips to build up Y here. So that just flips a coin 10 times more or less and turns it into trues and falses, zeros and ones. Then I compute the absolute value of the correlation statistic here. So there's sort of three things I'm doing here. I'm computing the correlation statistic, I'm taking the absolute value thereof, and then I'm rounding to two digits to make it readable for myself. And so I get 0.23. This is, of course, randomly generated data, so you may get different results. Slide 27. What about rank variables, though? I've sort of put that off. So the rest of the statistics I'll talk about today are all based on rank variables. And this measuring the system between two rank variables can be done using what's called Spearman's rank order correlation coefficient, or better known as Spearman's rho. That's the Greek letter rho. The rho of two variables is equal to, this is quite simple here, the Pearson correlation of those variables turned into ranks. So while Pearson correlation measures how linear the data is, how linear the relationship between X and Y is, Spearman measures what we might call monotonicity, or how non-decreasing the relationship is. So does an increase in X, is it associated with an increase in Y or not? Slide 28. So here I've just sampled some random data, which I show to you, and stored it in X. That's our norm, that's sampling from the normal distribution. And then I call the R function rank, which turns these numbers into ranks. You see that it begins at 1 and it leads up to 10 because there's 10 samples. Now, since it's sampled from a continuously valued distribution, there are no ties. But ties do come up a lot in work. Slide 29. R has many different ways to handle these ties. In fact, this function called rank I just showed you has a method called ties.method. It's an argument called ties.method, which controls how ties are resolved. So for instance, you can replace a series of ties with their average rank. That's the default behavior. But you also can use the rank of the first or last of a series of tied elements, and then simply don't skip. That is to say, so you have, if three things are tied for second place, all three of them are given 2, and then the next thing in the sequence is given 3. Or we can use the last. So in one case, instead of using 2 there, we'd use 4. Or we can put them in a completely random order. We can just sort of like randomly sample which one gets to go first. Or we can use the min or max of the tied element sequence and then actually do skip ranks. So it goes something like 1, 2, 2, 2, 5. You can play along with these at home to get a sense of what this looks like. Slide 30. Here I grab some data from the IRIS dataset, which we saw recently. I see it in the homework, I suppose. And here I have two things. I have the petal length and the sepal length of these three species of iris. First off, I'll compute by hand the ranks. I'll just use the default value, which takes an average. In the case of ties, call that x.r and y.r. We then compute the correlation method, and actually I explicitly tell it here to use Pearson because I've already converted these to ranks. And the answer is we get 0.88. So there is actually a quite strong correlation between the length of the petal and the length of the sepal, which sort of makes sense given that the sepal has to support the petal, just physically speaking. Or we can just use our built-ins like the correlation method. So here I say X and Y. I don't need to compute the ranks myself. R will do it internally. I just have to tell R that we're using the so-called Spearman method, which I do. as a keyword argument there. Slide 31. So here's an example of data that is strictly monotonic. That is to say, every increase in X is never associated with a decrease in Y. So as we go from left to right, Y values just keep going up. So that gives you a perfect Spearman correlation, because Spearman correlation gives you, it measures monotonicity. However, the Pearson correlation is a little bit smaller, because you see it's not quite a line, it's a curve. Next slide. Here we have a graph that is a relatively straight linear trend, but there's a bunch of outliers. You see there's five different points in the far right upper quadrant of this graph. The Spearman correlation, it tends to be more robust to outliers because it's not actually doesn't influence by like these large deviances that occur in the numerator of that covariance formula. It doesn't have anything equivalent. So those, you just get a small penalty for those. Whereas the Pearson correlation incurs a large penalty for those. It shrinks the value down. So in the presence of extreme outliers, the Spearman correlation statistic may be more appropriate. Slide 33. Compared to Pearson's R, Spearman's rho is, as I said, less sensitive to strict linearity, less sensitive to extreme outliers, but pleasantly has the same range and it has the same sign, at least in terms of how we interpret it. And it, of course, uses the same statistical test because ultimately the rho statistic is just the Pearson R statistic. So I can just run the same null hypothesis test using the core.test method. It's appropriate if only one of the two variables is rank, which I think you'll see in the homework. So if the other variable is continuous, that's fine. You still use the Spearman rho. In fact, just talking for my own practical purposes, if I'm going to compute the correlation between two variables, I tend to reach for this one first, unless I have time to like carefully look at a graph. Because it's rare that there's some strong reason to believe in an interval interpretation of the data. It's sort of a much more mechanistic story than is often appropriate for data. Slide 34. So a team of three different people, Kendall and later on Goodman and Kruskal, proposed an alternative family of rank correlation statistics, which is based on a rather different notion than simply just taking the rank. This is called, the notion here is called concordance. So I have to define something before I begin here. The function is called SGN, or the signum function. And the signum function is a function which is plus one if the value is greater than zero, negative one if the value is less than zero, and in this particular case at least, I'm going to say it's undefined if the value is exactly zero. So just keep this in your head. This is a function that sort of like turns a sign into plus one or negative one. Pretty straightforward. Slide 35. So let's define concordance, and we're going to use this notion of the signum function. Consider that we have two pairs of observations, x sub 0, y sub 0, and x sub 1, y sub 1. We'll say that this pair of observations, pair of pairs of observations to be quite specific, is concordant if the difference between the x's and the difference between y's have the same sign. And we'll say it's discordant otherwise. So concordant pairs, as you can see in the little graph there, define a line segment with a positive slope. Discordant pairs define a line segment with a negative slope. Slide 36. In the Goodman-Kruskal gamma, which is the first set of statistics, sort of the simplest set of statistics to use this notion of concordancy to talk about rank correlation, we compute whether we take every possible ordered pair of this form. And we then compute whether that pair of observations is concordant, discordant, or neither, which we'll call a tie. So if they're along the same line, for instance, they're a tie. Then we'll say big C is the number of concordant pairs, and D will be the number of discordant pairs. Then gamma will be defined as C minus D over C plus D. This, too, once again, has a range from negative 1 to positive 1, and it also has a known reference distribution. Very convenient for us. Slide 37. Kendall's tau, or specifically Kendall's tau sub b, if you want to be pedantic, is a variant of the Goodman statistic, even though it's actually historically slightly a bit earlier. It's a sort of complexification of the Goodman-Kruskal statistic family. So in Goodman-Kruskal gamma, we actually discard ties. In the Kendall-Tausa B, we apply a correction to the denominator, which essentially as a penalty to them. They're understood as to be being divergences from monotonicity, so we should put a little penalty to them. Because of this correction, for any given x and y, the gamma statistic will be greater than or equal to the tau statistic. In fact, if there are no ties, they'll be equal. If there are any ties, gamma will be larger. So here's an example where I'm using the Kendall statistic. It's built right into R. And here, once again, I'm computing the statistic, and I'm rounding it to two digits. I should note, unfortunately, R doesn't have a built-in implementation of the Goodman-Kruskal statistic, so most people just use Kendall and keep track of whether there are or are not ties. Slide 38. Compared to Spearman's row, the Kendall-Goodman-Kruskal statistical family are somewhat computationally more expensive to compute. That's because you have to do all pairs, and there are they're n squared over 2 minus n such pairs. So as n grows, this grows quadratically, which that makes it somewhat more computationally expensive to compute. So this, if you have enormous amounts of data, millions or billions of examples, this is not usually feasible. They have somewhat opaque behavior with respect to ties. Goodman-Kruskal simply ignore them. Kendall has this somewhat counterintuitive way of incorporating them into the denominator. And interestingly, it's something just watch out for. It's not a meaningful fact. They tend to have smaller magnitudes than the related Spearman coefficient. But I think the interpretation's a little bit clearer. There's a very clear graphical interpretation that's a little bit easier to get than the classical Spearman statistics. Slide 39. Thank you so much for listening and dealing with this somewhat unfortunate set of events that forces me to record this remotely. If you have questions, please email me, or if you think they'd be interesting to the group, start a discussion on Slack. I'll try to circulate a set of notes about interesting questions. And of course, remember this presentation is for remote presentation only. Please stay safe and don't share this more widely. Thank you so much. Have a good day.